Good evening, and thank you, Ian, for that very kind introduction. It's a pleasure for me to be able to join you this evening. And I'd also like to welcome to Australia the many visitors that are here. I hope you're enjoying your time in Sydney, learning about the wonderful country that's home to 22 million lucky people. So I hope you're learning about our country and enjoying what you see. This evening I really want to talk about some developments in the international economy and their implications for Australia. Now clearly that's not a new topic, because developments around the world have a profound impact on the Australian economy and on Australian financial markets, and no doubt they will continue to do so. But the unusual nature of developments abroad, particularly in the advanced economies, is changing the way in which global outcomes affect Australia, and this evening I'd like to talk about some of those changes. I think it's useful, though, to really start off with the big picture and the key global influences on the Australian economy over recent times. And here I just want to point to two. The first is very much a positive influence, and that's the strong growth over quite a few years in many emerging market economies, particularly those in Asia. The second, though, is a negative influence, and that's the fiscal, household balance sheet and banking problems in many of the world's advanced industrialised economies. Together, these two influences are reshaping the contours of the global economic landscape. They are also reshaping the configuration of interest rates and exchange rates that we're seeing here in Australia, and I'll talk more about that later. Now, the Asian story and its implications for us are well known. The strong growth in the region has led to a large increase in the prices of resources and agricultural commodities relative to manufactured goods. This has been to our considerable advantage, given our natural resource base and our stable investment climate. It's also meant that at a time when many advanced economies have been experiencing what is close to an investment drought, Australia has had the highest level of investment relative to GDP in over a century, and I'd expect further increases in that ratio over the next couple of quarters. And while this growth in Asia is clearly a positive for us, there are inevitably ups and downs in the region, and they're having a bigger influence on the Australian economy than they've ever had before. Reflecting this, we've recently seen the Chinese economic data discussed much more in Australia than just a few years ago. Earlier in the year, growth in China was clearly slowing, but the recent data have had a more positive tone, and growth appears to have stabilised, albeit at a lower rate than we've become used to over the past decade or so. Now, the story in the advanced economies is also well known, but it's much less positive. For too many years, public spending ran ahead of taxes, and the difference was financed by bond markets at low interest rates. In some countries, private sector debt also grew too quickly and banks mismanaged their balance sheets. And the result has been, and unfortunately it continues to be, a costly period of adjustment. Public finances have to be put on a sounder footing, households have to reduce their debt levels, and financial institutions need to strengthen their balance sheets. These adjustments take considerable time, and it's likely to be some years before they're complete. If this is how it turns out, then a protracted period of disappointingly slow growth seems in prospect for many of these economies. Now, these two stories, the Asian story and the advanced industrialised economy story, are of course interlinked. The ongoing momentum in the Asian region has provided some boost to the advanced economies over recent times. Conversely, the problems in these advanced economies have contributed to the recent slowing in Asian growth. This codependence is very much part of the world we live in. But codependence does not mean that it's inevitable that the sluggish growth in the advanced economies must cause growth in the world as a whole to be sluggish. With the right policy settings, it's not inconceivable that strong growth in Asia, driven by domestic demand, could continue despite the problems in the advanced economies. And Australia obviously has a very strong interest in this outcome, not least because we have benefited more from the growth of Asia so far than has any other industrialised economy. So much for these big picture influences. I now want to focus on some of the channels through which problems in the advanced industrialised economies are affecting the rest of the world, including us here in Australia. Now, the most obvious of these channels is the trade channel, where weaker demand from the advanced economies has weighed on exports from the rest of the world, including from Asia. This has acted as a drag on growth in Asia, although it's nothing like the experience that was seen in late 2008 and in 2009. For Australia, the direct trade links with the troubled advanced economies are not as large as they are for Asia, although we face important second-round effects through our trade with Asia as well as through softer commodity prices. A second channel is through the uncertainty that the problems in the advanced economies create, and this uncertainty clearly leads to decisions being delayed both by consumers and businesses. Now, the two big uncertainties that have attracted attention over recent times are the looming fiscal cliff in the United States and the question of how Europe resolves its fiscal and its banking problems. At least in terms of the European question, I think some progress is being made, although it's frustratingly slow. If you think back to a year ago, it was unclear whether the ECB would be prepared to buy sovereign debt in large quantities. It was unclear how the funding stresses in the banking system would be resolved. And it was unclear just how much political support there was for more centralised bank supervision, as well as for the various European financial support mechanisms. Yet a year on, in each of these areas, important decisions have been made. And collectively, these decisions have lessened the probability of a very bad outcome, although clearly more needs to be done there. Investors rightly want to see more than just high-level decisions from European summits. They want to see agreement on how those decisions are to be implemented, and then they want to see actual progress on implementation. Now, the uncertainty that these events have created is having an impact here. I think it's adversely affected confidence. It's, as I said before, led to the deferral of some decisions, and it's led to more cautious behaviour by both households and business. But the subdued level of confidence also has its domestic roots. Employment growth, the rate of asset price increases and consumption growth are all lower than they were over the decade to the mid-2000s. During that earlier period, the outcomes in these areas were very strong as the economy adjusted to low inflation and to the increased availability of credit. But this adjustment's now complete, and we're seeing a return to more normal patterns, and this has come as a disappointing surprise to many who thought that the previous outcomes were the norm. There's this gradual realisation that the future is likely to be different from the past. It's an important factor, an important domestic factor, I think, that's weighing on sentiment here. Now, a third channel in which the problems in the large industrialised economies having an effect is through the very accommodative stance of monetary policy in these economies. The United States, the Euro area, Japan, the United Kingdom, official interest rates are either zero or very close to zero, and the size of central bank balance sheets have increased markedly. Now, from one perspective, this setting of monetary policy is hardly surprising. Sluggish growth in many of the advanced economies means that little or no progress is being made at reducing very high rates of unemployment. At the same time, core inflation is subdued, and as a result, monetary policy is very accommodative. And with official interest rates effectively at zero, the setting of monetary policy is being achieved through expansion of central bank balance sheets. But from another perspective, what we are seeing is highly unusual. Since mid-2008, four of the world's major central banks, the Fed, the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, have all expanded their balance sheets very, very significantly, and a number have announced further increases. In total, the assets of these four central banks have already increased by the equivalent of around $5 trillion US dollars. That's around 15% of the combined GDP of the relevant economies. And we've not seen this type of planned, simultaneous, very large expansion of central bank balance sheets before. So in that sense, it is very unusual, and its implications are not yet fully understood. Now, this type of monetary expansion is supposed to work through a number of mechanisms. At the risk of oversimplifying things, I want to focus on just two of these. The first is that it increases the price of the assets that the central bank is buying, thus lowering the yields on those assets. With the Fed, the Bank of Japan, and the Bank of England all buying their own government's bonds, it's hardly surprising that the yields on those bonds are at very, very low levels. Similarly, in Europe, the prospect of the ECB buying the bonds of the troubled sovereigns has seen the yields on those bonds decline. And in the United States, the Fed's decision to purchase mortgage-backed securities has seen the yields on those securities fall. In general, these lower yields should provide some boost to spending, just as would lower interest rates for more conventional monetary policy. Now, the second mechanism is through asset allocation decisions as banks and investors adjust their portfolios following the sale of assets to the central bank. These sales lead to an increase in the balances that banks hold at the central bank, and in addition, where the ultimate seller of the asset is a non-bank, they also lead to an increase in bank deposits. At some point, the institutions holding these higher balances could be expected to conclude that there were other assets somewhere in the world that earned a risk-adjusted return above zero. As institutions seek out these other assets, their prices could be expected to rise. And the ever large size of the central bank balance sheets increases the incentive for institutions to seek out these other assets. There is evidence that this transmission channel of quantitative easing is working. Market participants report that at least in some areas the appetite for risk is slowly returning, and some investors are looking at how to improve their returns. Global stock markets have rallied since the middle of the year. Corporate bond spreads in the US and Europe have narrowed, and yields are around their lowest level on record. Corporate bond issuance in the US has also been strong recently, and it's picked up in Europe. Now, of course, these developments might not be sustained. Any appetite for increased risk-taking can easily be diminished again by a bad outcome somewhere else in the world. But for the time being, in some market segments at least, conditions are slowly improving, and it's not unreasonable to attribute some of this to the quantitative easing that's taken place. Indeed, this is what a textbook tells us should be happening. There's an important international dimension to this as well, and I'd like to now focus on that. When institutions look for alternatives to holding large deposits earning a near zero return, they look not just at assets or domestic assets, but at foreign assets as well. Not surprisingly, with the rest of the world doing better than the troubled advanced economies, many of the assets earning positive risk-adjusted returns are located outside the countries undertaking quantitative easing. And as a result of this, there's an incipient outflow of capital from these countries and, by an extension, downward pressure on their currencies. And, of course, this means that other currencies of other countries are under upward pressure, which by itself weighs on growth in these countries. This is not the end of the story, though, because there are some potential offsets to the contractionary effects of a higher currency. The first is that if quantitative easing is successful in boosting growth in the countries in which it's occurring, then the world economy would be stronger and we would all benefit as a result of that. The second is that any rise in asset prices that occurs because of the capital flows could also provide a boost to the domestic economy. And the third is that the contractionary effects of any appreciation can be countered with more stimulatory domestic policy settings, including lower interest rates than would otherwise have been the case. Now, this, by necessity, has been a rather quick tour through the effects of quantitative easing, and I apologise if it hasn't been quick enough for a dinner. But the key point is that quantitative easing and weak growth in the large industrialised economies is likely to lead, for a time at least, to upward pressure on other currencies and lower interest rates around the world. For the countries whose currencies are under upward pressure, this can be uncomfortable. However, it should not come as a surprise that the countries that are doing relatively well see their currencies gain in value relative to those that aren't doing so well. And it's this movement in exchange rates that is one of the key ways in which low interest rates in the large financial centres are transmitted around the world. Now, the real world is obviously considerably more complex than the one that I've just discussed. But over recent times, a number of non-crisis countries with floating currencies have indeed found themselves in this general position. That is, they've had low nominal interest rates and a relatively high exchange rate. This list could include, to varying degrees, Canada, South Korea, Switzerland, New Zealand, some of the Nordic countries, and there are others as well. In each of these cases, interest rates are very low by historical standards, and in a number of them, the central bank has recently drawn attention to the upward pressure on their currency. Now, this configuration of low interest rates and a high exchange rate is one of the consequences of the problems in the advanced industrialised economies. It is inevitably affecting the composition of growth in the countries concerned, though it's important to point out that it need not be inconsistent with trend growth. Industries producing trader goods and services tend to be disadvantaged relative to the non-trader parts of the economy, and low interest rates help create an environment where investors are prepared to borrow, to buy assets. To some extent, of course, this is desirable, as it's one of the channels through which monetary policy works, but it can also increase the probability of imbalances developing in credit and asset markets, with potential implications for financial and macroeconomic stability. And given the experience of a number of countries over the past decade, it's hardly surprising that the central banks in quite a few countries have recently indicated that they are watching developments in the credit and asset market area very closely. So what are the implications of all this for Australia? And I want to end here with four brief points. The first is that the primary reason the Australian dollar is high compared to its historical average is the large shift in world relative prices that I spoke about at the outset. This shift has been to Australia's considerable advantage, and the high exchange rate has helped us navigate our way through what is a once-in-a-century investment boom. The economy's recorded solid growth, the unemployment rate remains relatively low, inflation is consistent with the target, public debt is low, and the banking system is sound. I think it's fair to say that few countries could make such claims. The second point is the type of portfolio flows that I've talked about earlier do appear to be having an effect here. The effect is perhaps clearest in the government bond market with the yields near historic lows, but it's also evident in the credit markets with credit spreads paid by banks having fallen recently. It's also likely that these portfolio flows help explain why the exchange rate has changed little since mid-year, despite a general softening of the global outlook and a decline in Australia's key commodity export prices. The third point is that Australia's interest rates remain above those in other developed economies. The main reason for this is that the rate of return on new investment in Australia is higher than in many other countries, and that's evidenced by our very high investment ratio. The very low interest rates in many other countries should not be seen as a good thing or something for us to aspire to. They reflect those countries' difficult economic circumstances and particularly the low risk-adjusted returns available on new investment. The fourth and final point is that while our interest rates are relatively high, compared with other countries, they are relatively low compared with historical averages. I think the international connections that I've talked about tonight help explain this. These lower than average interest rates are importantly providing some support to demand in the economy. There's also some sign that they've led to a slight improvement in the property market, although there's been little change in the appetite for debt. It would appear that, at least for the moment, the lower interest rates, rather than encouraging household borrowing, have allowed many households with mortgages to repay their loans slightly more quickly than was previously the case. And as in many other countries, these trends in credit and asset prices will obviously need close monitoring over the period ahead. So to conclude, these competing influences from Asia and from the troubled advanced economies are having a significant effect on the Australian economy, on our exchange rate, and on our interest rates. They're creating challenges for policymakers and for investors, and they've added to the general sense of uncertainty. What seems clearer, though, is that Australia's strong trade links with Asia, our solid financial system, our flexible markets, and our credible policy frameworks mean that we're in a better position than many other countries to deal with these challenges. And I wish you all the best of luck as you navigate your way through this complex and uncertain world, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions. Thank you very much. Oh, yeah, sorry. What's importantly important is growth in aggregate demand and how that balances with the supply potential of the economy. And aggregate demand growth has been extraordinarily strong. We've had, as I said, a once-in-a-century investment boom, and that's provided a tremendous strength to aggregate investment and total demand in the economy. So I think if you look at kind of it from that perspective and the aggregate outcomes, it looks like the settings that we have are broadly right. They've delivered trend growth in the economy, inflation at the target, a low unemployment rate. I think the issues going forward really are about the configuration of interest rates and exchange rates that are likely to be needed to keep that going, and that's really an open question.
Just from the perspective of the boom in Australia, we were at a conference last week in Brisbane where, I'm not going to put you against one of your RBA board members, but one of the questions or responses that he had was that Dr. John Edwards was that Australia was actually had experienced a mining investment boom and a mining price boom, but still had a mining output boom to come. Do you share that view?
We often think of this kind of coming in three phases. There was the price phase, the terms of trade, the big run-up in the terms of trade, which looked like they peaked in the September quarter last year. Then there's the investment phase, which we're currently in. The capital stock in Australia is increasing at a rate of around 5% a year. I mean, it's extraordinarily fast relative to other countries and relative to our own history. And then when that capital stock gets put in place, we're going to get the export receipts from that. So from late 2014 and going forward into the few years after that, it's likely that we're going to see a very large increase in export volumes. So you're right, it's really a three-stage process, and we're kind of in the second phase of that with strong investment, but the third phase is coming, and we'll see a very large lift in Australia's exports as a result of that.
Yeah, you spoke about how the large central banks have expanded their balance sheets in such an unprecedented manner. And I just wanted to get your thoughts about is there any limits to that? And at some point in 2013, should the authorities understand that austerity isn't going to work as well as what they hope, and that we do need growth, could we see those balance sheets expand further without consequences for bond markets?
The first part of your question, could this continue? I think it could. There is up to some limit, to kind of no really effective boundary to the ability of central banks to create money. As long as there are assets out there to buy them, they can buy those assets with money that they effectively create. The issue is whether that would continue to be effective. The money creation that's already occurred has driven government bond yields down to extraordinarily low levels. I suspect there's not much, in most countries, there's not much benefit from a further reduction in government bond yields. There may be a reduction in getting other credits, benefit in getting other credit spreads down. And then once these economies start to show sustainable growth and inroads into unemployment, the question will become how to unwind all this. I presume that a number of these central banks won't be that keen on selling government securities into the market quickly, but there are other ways in which they can effectively lock up these higher balances at the central bank through reserve requirements or other means. So there is the capability, I think, to do more of this, to buy other assets, to push the credit spreads down, and there is the ability to unwind it when the time comes. And the difficult policy question that they're all going to confront is, what's the right time to start moving from doing more of this to doing less of it? And that's going to be very, very difficult, because we don't really have much historic, we don't have any historical experience about the unwinding of these episodes. So it's going to be a major challenge.
I think there's one more down the back.
I'm Joanna Heath from the Financial Review. I had a couple of questions related to the dollar. The first one is, the Australian dollar now is higher than it was on the day before Melbourne Cup Day last year, before the most recent 125 basis point rate cut cycle was started. Have interest rate cuts lost their ability somehow to affect the value of the Aussie dollar? And my second question is the RBA currently doing anything in an attempt to limit the buying pressure on the Australian dollar?
Let me take the second question first. If I think about what are the really fundamental economic reforms that Australia has made over the last 30 years, at the top of the list is the decision to float the currency. It's been an incredibly stabilising influence. There are periods where, when it moves, people feel very uncomfortable about the movement, but if you look back over the run of history, I think it's difficult to escape the conclusion that a floating exchange rate has delivered tremendous benefits for this country. A decision to intervene by the Reserve Bank and to move away from that model that's worked would be a very big one. Historically, we've been prepared to intervene in for short periods of time when there's either market dislocation or the exchange rate is fundamentally away from where it should be, and that's having a major impact on the economy. So that they remain options, but the threshold for that type of activity is quite high. And while it's a bit surprising the currency hasn't come down, as I said in my remarks, as the outlook for the world economy has softened and interest rates here have come down, the currency is still not at the point where I think you can make a strong conclusion that is fundamentally overvalued, particularly given the considerations that I was talking about. Your first question about whether monetary policy has lost its potency on the exchange rate, I think you've got to see that in the context of the major influence on the exchange rate is, in fact, the terms of trade, the commodity prices. That's why the exchange rate's high. And the portfolio flows that have come about as a result of quantitative easing, I think, are another factor. So it's very hard to disentangle the effect of interest rates on the currency, because interest rates are so correlated with these other factors that I was talking about. But the effects are not of small movements in interest rates, I don't think, are particularly large on the currency. It's these bigger forces that are really driving it at the moment.
Thanks, Adam. Just on that question of the strength in the Aussie dollar, does that mean, from what you just said, you wouldn't support some of the ideas that have been touted about quarantining the impact of portfolio flows on the Aussie dollar through the bonds buying that we've seen?
Yeah. Well, really you're talking about whether the Reserve Bank should undertake very large-scale intervention in the currency markets. And as I said, in principle, the argument for doing that would arise if you thought the currency was fundamentally overvalued and was having a really adverse effect on the economy. So that possibility is not ruled out. But it would be a very big step to kind of move away from a system that's served us very, very well for a long period of time. It's a step that in extremis we would be prepared to contemplate, but it would be quite a difficult step to take, particularly when there are other policy responses that can be made. And I've talked tonight about, in effect, this trade-off between a high exchange rate and low interest rates, and we're seeing this around the world. Many countries are grappling with this. The currencies are higher than they expected to see them, and in response to that, they're lowering their interest rates. We're not seeing a mass rush to fixed exchange rates or large-scale intervention, and I think the reasons for that are clear. The benefits of the floating currency are strong, and decisions to move away from that would be very, only undertaken in very difficult circumstances.
Philip, I have a question. You spoke a moment ago about the high level of the currency primarily being due to the high terms of trade. Our commodity forecasts are that the prices will remain quite high, around current levels really when we think of it in an index sense, but partly because the cost base sitting under those prices has increased quite sharply. And my question is, if commodity prices and the terms of trade at that level aren't as profitable domestically for miners and so on, does that make a difference to the currency implications?
I'm not sure whether it makes a difference to the currency. What I have noticed is that as the iron ore and coal prices came back over the last few months, or declined over the past few months, that there has been some scaling back of investment intentions in the real part of the economy, particularly in the iron ore and coal sectors. And that has brought, as we've said publicly, that's brought forward when we expect the peak in mining investment to occur. A little while back, we expected that to be kind of late next year, and now it looks more like in the middle of next year. And so that's brought forward the timing of the peak, which has implications for the strength of the economy going forward. And that change in the slight moderation in the outlook for investment, together with the softer global outlook, were important factors in the decision that we made earlier this month.